How would you like to become investable and raise your company's valuation? Matteo Tri will tell us now, and he's a finance leader, investor, and board advisor who has spent nearly two decades working with businesses at pivotal moments of growth. And he's a former CFO across biotech, SaaS, and renewable energy, and he now brings the perspective of an M&A investor currently overseeing $480 million in acquisitions. And since 2017, he created the Global Growth Blueprint to address a gap in entrepreneurial education, wealth creation. So, Matteo, tell us about how can entrepreneurs become investable, and what are most entrepreneurs missing when it comes to making themselves investable?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu, mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
First of all, thank you very much for having me today here, Lily. Yeah, it's a question I've asked myself so many times in my career because, eventually, you know, capital is what really drives businesses growth effectively. You know, one latest research showed that about $13 trillion is the amount of private capital invested. So that's the capital that we don't know too much about, because many knows about public capital, many know about the company that, you know, very well-known household names. So let me tell you about what I established in 2017. I realized that there was a gap in education for entrepreneurs. I don't think that gap will go away for a few generations, I would say. So this is really evergreen, because there's so much education about wealth management, which is obviously a lot to do also with my finance profession. But when it comes to wealth creation, there's not too much education about it. And most of the time you can see entrepreneurs really having to guess, you know, what is the best thing to do. It's very, very complex. So this is why I established this global growth blueprint, which actually I call the exponential blueprint. It's a system I developed after nearly three decades in finance. It was spent across startups, scale-ups, mergers and acquisition deals, which is my current activity, really. Now, it revolves around what I call the high valuation triangle, effectively three pillars that every high-performing company has mastered. So we study this company and we see that this happens over and over again. There are these three pillars. Would you let me tell you more about these three pillars, Lily?
Yes, please.
Okay. So first of all, the first pillar is called intellectual property monetization. So when you got an idea, that idea obviously needs to be executed. It needs to be validated. What's the end result? It needs to become an income engine. So that's what investors are looking for. They're looking for transferable value that comes from really what we call valuation engine. Okay. That's the second phase is the second pillars actually is called succession planning, which also can be referred to the next phase of a business. Usually the startup phase is where you have the idea, you validate it, then you have to scale up the business. And so the second pillar is succession planning. So effectively is building leadership depth that attracts investor. And this is where we see so many failures, very, very unnecessary failures, because your product is on the market already. You have executed the most difficult part, which is startup, but effectively founders, they need to transform themselves, because when it comes to scale up, you need to become a CEO effectively. And that's where education is. So let's say these two pillars, they take you very, very high in a valuation hierarchy because you're already worth money. But what else can you do after you got an idea that becomes a valuation engine, an income engine as well, after you build your leadership team? Well, the next phase is to go global expansion. So you scale beyond borders so that you can achieve an exponential valuation. And again, here, many, many businesses, they do it the wrong way. They think they need to push the foot on the accelerator. They think they need to open as many offices as possible in as many countries. In actual fact, what we see with a big household name is completely the opposite. They just leverage themselves out of the intellectual property they created when they were in the early stage. And then they become global with distribution, with partnership, with joint venture, as we see. So this is the high valuation triangle, which is my system effectively. Yeah.
Thank you. For someone who is getting started, who is just starting kind of like to create their business, where would they need to start to make sure that they have the highest possible valuation? What are the 10 commandments for someone to properly create their infrastructure so that they grow to the to the highest possible valuation?
Yeah, well, 10 is quite a high number of commandments. You know, let me try and tell you what I think, you know, because obviously it could be 20, it could be 50, you know, but let me give you the 10, the most precious commandments, which I think they can be followed. Now, the first one I would say, let's say value first and capital later, okay? So what I mean by this is if you have an idea, you need to validate it, yeah? Only after you validate it, you go for capital. Because if the idea is just a vague idea, it's just not worth. You know, you cannot really approach anyone, any investor. Now, the second commandment I would say, again, monetize intellectual property. Now, protect what makes you different, and after you protect, you profit. And I would say, after you profit, you protect. And after you protect, you profit again. So it's actually a circle which allow the business to really build a moat which is invaluable. Now, obviously, each situation is different, and history tells us how the IP needs to be used in the correct manner and at the right time as well. Let's say another commandment. Well, if it's not documented, it doesn't exist. Okay. So I would say this, make sure that there's always documentation, there's always proof about, you know, what you're creating effectively. I know it sounds a bit simple to say, but I think sometimes simplicity is fundamental. Now, the other commandment, let me talk about leadership. Yeah, I think leadership depth equals valuation strength. Now, most of the time you will see that founders that may be control obsessed, they really delay creating leadership. They think the opposite of what they should think. They should think that by creating the leadership, they're actually not incurring a cost. That cost is actually multiplying the valuation of the business, because the investors, when they come in, they want to see the valuation engine at play. The other thing I would say, I think it's number 5 now, yeah? When you go global, yes, you have to think about geography, but before you think about the geography, think about the mindset. What mindset will take you global? What sort of partnership? Yeah. For example, how did they go global? Well, they went global by looking for distributors. They didn't go global by creating new manufacturing infrastructure. For example, Coca-Cola, they found bottling distributor, for example, bottling manufacturer. Okay, we're number 6 now, I think, yeah. Okay, number 6, let me go back to finance. Cash flow, in my view, is oxygen. Just don't run out of it. I always say there are 2 possible ways to die in business. One is sudden, effectively. Lack of profitability is slow death. It's a bit like, you know, it's the difference between heart attack and cancer. Let's call it like that, you know. Now, surprisingly, we see profitable scale-up failing because of this, because they don't know how to manage cash flow. And that is particularly upsetting, because we all lose. Our society lose, because there is loss of jobs, there is loss of an economy when a business business really fails, there is a loss of the product we used to buy from that company. So that's very unnecessary, unfortunately. Okay, number seven, I would say, never scale in a chaotic manner. Fix the engine first. Yeah, there might be something that needs to be fixed, you know, so just be calm, just go back to what is not working and try and fix it. Yeah. Number eight, let me think about the brand. Now brand, let's call it, is the emotional side of valuation. Okay. But it's really, really important, because brand is the intangible value that acts like a magnet for the two people that got money, customer and investors, effectively. So customer, you want customer and investor to call you for your bank details because you want them to pay you, effectively. Number nine. Okay, if you cannot measure it, you just cannot manage it, yeah? So you can only manage what is measurable. Again, this is quite a common sense, really. But sometimes common sense is what could be missing, especially in a scale-up phase. Number 10, okay. Okay, let me actually give you this, you know, as a commandment. Let me give you the name of my book, which is free word, effectively. It's Fail, Pivot, Scale. Okay, now it's not a slogan, but it's a cycle, because what we tend to see is that if you look back in history, if you look at the household name, the case studies in the world, we will find that each business that is now very successful, they've gone through this, you know. Let's say Amazon, they failed, then they pivot, and then they scale, effectively. Now, treating failure as a necessary occurrence is fundamental, because you know, that's what a business does, effectively. You never really achieve what you imagine you were going to achieve when you first started, because, you know, let's say, yeah, if you think about the business that exists today, I mean, when Apple was founded in the 80s, actually, they didn't think they were going to end up with the iPod. They didn't think they were going to kill the iPod to invent the iPhone. So this is a very important slogan for me, and that's the title of my book, actually.
Tell us about what are the most important steps for someone to take to achieve a high valuation.
Okay, well, each situation is unique. And there are five different phases in business. So the first question I would ask, which phase are you? It could be one of these five. It could be one, startup; two, scale up; three, stagnation; four, crisis; five, exit. It's one of these five, yeah. Depending on where you are, the high valuation triangle will adapt, yeah. Say, for example, if you are in the transition from startup to scale up, generally speaking, you have already built your intellectual property. So generally speaking, your biggest priority is to build your leadership team. And you build your leadership team by achieving three goals, effectively. Three leaders who can do three jobs. Number one, sell. Number two, produce. Number three, generate cash flow. Now, usually I tend to do a comparison with sports here, like a football team, yeah, where the leadership team needs to be created in such a way that you got a very good leader when it comes to selling, then you, which is effectively the equivalent of an attacker, somebody who scores goals, effectively. Then you need somebody who's very good in midfield, like an operation director, somebody who knows how to manage operation. And then you need somebody on the back, somebody on defense, usually it's finance. Because, you know, the other objective of a business is to generate cash flow. So three big goals, just to make it really simple: sell, produce, generate cash flow. And in this particular case, really the founder to be successful becomes a CEO and it delegates to these three leaders.
Thank you. What are some good ways for someone to add value to their company, aside from what you mentioned already?
Yeah, this is where each situation is different. Each situation deserves its own judgment. Yeah. I personally believe, you know, I used to run a balanced scorecard approach when I used to work for a FTSE 100 company, $20 billion valuation. But you can apply the same method to obviously very, very small organization. What I would say, we were always finding that out of 20 metrics, 11 or 10 were doing okay. The other 9, 10, they were not doing so well. So there's always a way to improve. But when it comes to valuation, I would diagnose effectively what is missing from the high valuation triangle. For example, again, this is just an example. I could make so many examples. If you're a company that is stagnating, so effectively the sales are not growing anymore, a way to increase the valuation in that particular circumstance is perhaps to rejuvenate the team, maybe to see what's going on. Maybe the pricing strategy is not correct. Maybe the intellectual property monetization engine is not working the way it should. Maybe competitors are really achieving good results, and also we need to take into account. Because, yeah, you know, market shifts, customer behavior changes, and the best CFO, I mean, obviously I'm myself a CFO by trade, really, they always look what's happening externally to the business. Example, the interest rate market. Example, yeah, there could be a situation where you have very low unemployment, very high interest rates. So that could signal a contraction ahead, yeah. So behaviors have to be intelligent. But yes, I would say each one of those five stages deserve its own treatment. But I would always go back to my high valuation triangle.
Thank you. Tell us about monetizing intellectual property. What do you mean there? And where would someone get the funds if they're just getting started and they don't have an investor?
Intellectual property monetization is the greatest wealth creator that is available to all of us, effectively. So What is the difference between having an intellectual property monetization strategy and not having one? Is the same difference as, say, you are selling a service to somebody, okay? But then you become so good at selling that service that it becomes a method, yeah? Now, that method then becomes your intellectual property. You could actually have many methods. I'm talking about just one method in this particular case. So that method could become productized, yeah? So I'll give you an example. I was actually working with a consulting firm in London, and they came to me with an EBITDA of, I remember it was 40,000 pounds. And they were looking for a valuation of between 100 and 150,000 pounds, a multiple of EBITDA. Now, we went back to what they did, and what they did for customer, they did it so well, they didn't realize they could have actually created toolkit, they could have created additional revenue streams, yeah? They could have created even, you know, revenue from, for example, special tools they could have created for the customer. 5 or 6 revenue stream. When I interrogated them about the way the service was provided, I was able to increase the valuation in front of banks and investors from, we're talking about very small business here, from £150,000 to £400,000. But that's because we created what we called a productization of the consulting service that were actually given. Now, for somebody who just starts, my advice is you need to be very passionate about solving a problem. After you have created the solution, you need to sell lifetime value to your customer. So not transactional value. I'm talking about really lifetime value, because a customer needs to be able to buy from you for a number of years, forever, hopefully. And that means more than one revenue stream. Yeah. So for somebody who just started, I would strongly prove your concept and validate it. So validate it with initially some investment, some sacrifice, yeah, because that prototype that you start to use could actually produce some very small result, yeah. Those small results you can actually show them to a customer who is willing to buy big, yeah. Let's say somebody wants to buy, I don't know, let's say 100 kilo of recipe. Show them the first 500 grams, yeah. Show them this is what I'm able to extract from this particular matrix. Will you put an order, or will you commit to buy hundreds of kilos if I produce more? Now, that letter from a potential customer, the letter of expression of interest, is really is already a currency. Is already money. Money that you can use against an investor, really, and that's really, really, really important, because that's where you start to. You don't have money, but you have a currency in your hand. It's a letter from a customer, yeah. So I would always say go and do that before you approach an investor, and then obviously you go forward with a, let's call it, after the concept, you go the validation. Then we go through the development, and then we go through the deployment. Yeah.
Thank you. Where can someone find out how to monetize their intellectual property? And what I mean is, like, what are the gaps where they're not currently monetizing aspects of their intellectual property? How can they figure this out? Like, what should they be looking at to discover what gaps in their productization and monetization they currently have? So that they can leverage their intellectual property to the max. What things would you recommend they look at?
Okay, in terms of general evaluation situation, there's a valuation scorecard that I can offer, and also an IP monetization scorecard, just to answer the first question. So after the first question have been answered, it's about really getting deep into what is the unique selling point that the business is looking to achieve, if I to create, yeah. The other thing I would say is never work alone with these things without an expert. And you do need a lawyer all the time. See, for example, if you find a way to sell royalties to your customer and you don't really do the contract well with the lawyer, you may regret it for the rest of your life, because royalty is a very complex instrument that deserves really the right legal document. So I would say each situation is really unique. Yeah, say medical technology, biotechnology, they all lend themselves to intellectual property, and each situation really needs to be looked at with its own right. So I wouldn't be able to say really without having an exact example how exactly to treat it, but I would definitely say this: make sure that there is a problem to be solved, and you have potentially a lifetime value solution for a customer, something that it goes on for a long time, not just a transactional product that the customer will buy. And always think about creating a method. You don't have to necessarily file a patent. If you own a process, if you own a method, and again, you document it, yeah, you have to document it, that produces results that the competition cannot match, then you will start to own intellectual property, and then you can start really your journey towards monetizing. But don't do it alone.
Thank you. What aspects of your intellectual properties should someone consider protecting as a minimum?
Yeah, there are several type of aspect. Yeah. So we got the. I'll give you some list here. Just giving the first. We got a trademarks, which is very simple. It's just a name, effectively. The name could be, however, important for the brand. You know, to protect the brand. The patent is the invention. Effectively, you protect the invention, but each situation again needs to be taken with its own caution, because sometimes it may not be useful to actually publish a patent. The other aspect, which are potentially not many people talk about, one is registered design, and the other one is copyright. Now, I'll give an example about registered design. Registered design is actually the surprising thing about registered design is that is not examined in Europe, in the UK. So it doesn't go for examination the same way as it goes for patent, but it protects sometimes more than a patent, you know? So it's a very, very fundamental difference. Say, for example, if you are developing a product, and you don't protect your design, you just publish the patent, but you don't protect the design, you don't register the design effectively, what might happen is that someone might copy your product, and even if you got a patent, you're off the market because somebody has already taken advantage of your invention. So I would always suggest an IP audit, an intellectual property audit, in which you will find exactly your position with all these various instruments. Yeah.
Thank you. Tell us more about the Exponential Blueprint newsletter. What are some really important insights that most entrepreneurs who want to become investable should look at?
Yeah, thank you for that. The Exponential Blueprint is actually something that I started this year in January 2025. And is now trusted by more than 20,000 founders, investors, CFOs as well, and also C-suite executive. You know, there are lots of people there who work for the big accounting firm. You know, there are lots of investors as well. Now, the Exponential Blueprint started as a requirement for me, effectively, to own my own. My own network, as opposed to relying on algorithm on LinkedIn or YouTube and all these other platforms, effectively. So to have a dialogue with my network. And generally speaking, with the Exponential Blueprint, I go through every week. Now it's every Tuesday, through the high valuation triangle. And I go through lots of case studies. And the way I develop the newsletter every week is different. Obviously, there's a different subject, there's a different case study, there's a household name, but there's also a case study from my career. So I tend to show a negative and a positive case studies about how a business might have approached the evaluation triangle. But there are also some situations where, regardless of playbook, it's really about how a business really behaves in front of the events. I'll give you an example. Kodak was the inventor of digital photography, but they were making so much money on films that they neglected their invention. So what happened with that is, obviously, competitors came behind Kodak, and eventually Kodak went bankrupt. You know, that's a behavior where I was saying before, protect and profit. Yeah, so that was an example I put on my newsletter. Now another opposite example is, for example, Apple was on the verge of bankruptcy in 1997, and it reinvented itself, effectively. And Apple was successful because it completely changed initially the way we downloaded music. It became such a different company. But you know, for those who remember, 20 years ago, the iPod was phenomenal. It used to dominate, you know, everywhere in the world when it comes to sort of, you know, music listening. And amazingly, they decided to kill it because they invented another product called the iPhone. And now the iPhone is dominating the world, effectively. So what I tend to say in the exponential blueprint, I tend to always tell stories about how you can achieve success well beyond the book, the playbook, effectively, because it's about really navigating around markets, navigating around competitors, navigating around what customer wants, you know, always being very, very, very attentive about what's happening.
Thank you. Tell us three case studies of entrepreneurs or companies you've worked with where you've optimized the way they were monetizing their intellectual property. And if you don't have such case studies, tell us about three cases where you have helped them optimize another part of their business that was failing, and how did that work out in terms of profit?
Yeah, let me tell you about three completely different cases in which I've been involved. Now, the first one was a medical technology company that was stagnating, but they had big potential because they had big margin, they had a big intellectual property. But they were doing very little sales. And in the previous 10 years, before me, before arriving as a CFO, they had only raised £500,000. And when I joined, there was a clear opportunity to sell software as a service. So it's effectively the SaaS model, as well as the hardware model. So you're going from one-off revenue, so effectively you always have to sell to somebody, very lumpy revenue, by the way, every month it was like a roller coaster, you know, steady, much more steady revenue, and a plan to expand in the USA, but they needed money, but they were making very little money compared to what they needed. They were making, like, you know, 1.5 million. So interestingly, I was noticed on LinkedIn by an investor, and they actually approached me, and we started a conversation, and we started to have a conversation. We went through the full cycle, went through the term sheet, then eventually the due diligence. We got £5 million private venture debt. 1 year later, because the company was so strong in R&D, it was spending in research and development, they got a big order from the USA. Was a big change, you know. So suddenly, a big transformation. Now, I would say a second transformation in the same company was when we implemented the employee share scheme. Now, as you know, you know, we read so many times in the press about the motivated staff, leadership that is not good enough, and etc., bad management, and etc. Personally, I tell you this, you know, employee share ownership is the biggest cure you can find in any workplace to eliminate all problem of motivation, to really be successful as a business. And obviously, you have to have the right mindset as a founder, because the founder were very open to share wealth with the employees. That changes everything, because we've seen it with big household names like NVIDIA. 6,000 people have become millionaire because they became employees. So that's huge, you know. Another case of transformation was for a company in a totally different type of situation. It was a very large company in the wastewater sector. They had $2 billion sales, but they were in crisis. They'd actually announced a loss of £25 million. And they brought me in to refinance and to possibly recover the loss, to refinance $120 million. Now, they told me that I was going to stay for 1 year, but effectively after 10 months, we refinanced the $120 million. The financial results were astounding. We recovered €27 million free cash flow, and we recovered £25 million loss. But they asked me to stay for another 2 years, because after refinancing and after recovering the loss, they asked me to restructure the business because they wanted to sell it effectively. So they wanted to get out of where they were. Now, during that time, I learned so much about tough situation, because you have to restructure the company, you have to cut costs, you have to cut 70% of all staff, all costs. there was a very dysfunctional board. I was a chairman of a steering committee, which is part of what I was doing there. I was doing the Financial Times board director program. And eventually we restructured the business. We turned it back to profitability. We completely transformed the margin of the business. We went from 9% to 32%, which was unbelievable. So that was fantastic. You know, that was a transformation. Another transformation, he asked me for free of that. So it was for an acquisition we made. You know, there was an acquisition in the retail banking sector. And in that situation, we had to go through the due diligence. It was a very important acquisition for the business because they wanted to go international. And during the diligence, we found an overstatement, say €1 million overstatement of financial position, let's call it that, but balance sheet position. So that meant, you know, a big change to the program. So we went through the post-acquisition phase and eventually we were able to resolve the problem, but that took a big transformation in the information technology part of the business as well. So yeah, I'll give you free transformation, hopefully.
Thank you. Tell us what could possibly go wrong if someone doesn't protect their intellectual property, for example, like trademarking the name that they use for their company and that kind of thing.
Yeah, what could happen if you don't protect is pretty much the loss of value, potentially the death of the business. Yeah, let's call it. Let's be quite extreme on this. That's what happened to some household names. Yeah, I was mentioning Kodak before. But yes, we all remember BlackBerry as well. Probably BlackBerry was, they did have also the intellectual property to do what Apple did, but they didn't act on it. They didn't protect it. They were not fast enough. Yahoo had an opportunity to buy Google. They had an opportunity to make an acquisition. They were not really protecting their own market. They were not innovating the way Google was innovating effectively, and they lost the market share. But generally speaking, to go more into the details about how lack of protection of intellectual property can cost you pretty much everything, is competitors will take the market away from you. The Kodak example with the iPhone, you know, it's an example as well. Samsung as well, yeah.
Thank you. What would you say most 6 and 7 figure businesses do wrong in general for raising their company's valuation?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is where I have to say the concept of valuation sometimes is that the biggest mistake I see is that they treat valuation like a financial event instead of a strategic outcome. Okay, so what do I mean by that? So many founders will chase funding before proving scalability. Now, scalability is a simple concept, effectively. It means, you know, for every extra dollars I put into the business, I will do exponentially more money. And more and more money I put in, effectively, the more money I will make, effectively. Yeah. So so they usually undervalue their intellectual property. They don't maximize it. They usually overwork themselves. They fail to build systems that work without them. I always say that investors will buy engines, not personalities. So effectively, they invest actually the less charisma, obviously, depending on situation, of course, yeah. They buy valuation engine. They buy effectively transferable value. Now, this is what eventually create investability, transferable value. So if your business depend on you showing up every day, you just don't have a business. You just have a job with a logo, really.
Thank you. What would you say makes someone investable from a personality, charisma, and other personal traits kind of perspective?
Yeah, usually investors, they value so much more the ability to react than the ability to invent something in the first place. Yeah. That's what history tells us. History tells us that those who have been successful are those who have understood that they needed really to discover more and more about themselves, and they need to discover more and more about their business, and they knew that failure was effectively an outcome that was gonna be data, a diagnosis, not the end of everything, really. So this is why actually I created this book called Fail People Scale, because it's the exact picture of a successful entrepreneur.
Thank you. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
Thank you, Lily. In fact, we've already spoken about the newsletter, the Exponential Blueprint. Yeah. So the Exponential Blueprint is the newsletter where people can subscribe for free. And it's, you know, it's been a fantastic achievement. But what I've created on demand, obviously, in the last few weeks, because of the book Fail People Scale, is only going to be published on the 1st of March 2026. I created a live journey of this book, effectively, which is like a premium newsletter, which is a bit light touch, should we say, yeah? Compared to a community. It's not like a community where, you know, you have meetings every week, every month. There's one or 2 hours every month we're meeting, and effectively it's a community that's only starting, and it's called the High Valuation Code, effectively. And it's and every week there is a newsletter with a valuation scorecard. This valuation scorecard, throughout the year, participant will get 1,040 potential scores for their valuation readiness, and so basically, I wanted to effectively sort of productize, and it's available on the link to be able to show, really, and I'm very proud of it, because sometimes when people buy a book, they just buy the book, and then they don't necessarily get all the lessons, because. Yeah, sometimes, you know, there's nobody to ask a question. Instead, you know, what I decided, you know, while I'm writing the book, while it's been published, this is a live journey, and it's not very demanding at all, because it's, I think the price is about, you know, like $20 a month or something like that.
Thank you.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.